Welcome to Rails with Jason. Hey, I want to tell you about something. If you struggle with writing tests for your Rails applications, specifically RSpec tests, I have something for you. At my website, codewithjason.com, I have a whole bunch of articles on Rails testing that I wrote. Here's a couple examples of what you can find there. You can find a repeatable step-by-step guide to writing integration tests with Capybara. That's where I share my formula that I use every time I write a Capybara test that makes it pretty easy. There is the ultimate guide to RSpec and Capybara tests. And there's also mocks and stubs in plain English. These are just a few examples of dozens and dozens of Rails testing articles that I've written at codewithjason.com. I also have a free Ruby testing micro course that you can download. It's a 4-part course, pretty easy to go through. Hundreds of developers have already downloaded the course. You can join them by going to codewithjason.com and downloading the micro course. I also have a book called Rails Testing for Beginners. The book can be purchased as just the book or the book plus a video package where I walk through the book and show you everything in the book. Again, all these things are available at codewithjason.com. Now on to the episode. Welcome to Rails with Jason. I'm here today with Andrew Culver, founder and developer of Bullet Train. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Andrew, how many takes did it take us to get the intro right?
Not too bad, actually. 3, which I would say is probably like a record low for me. If you reach out to some of the other people I've done podcasts with, just got a lot of questions up front about how we want to do this thing.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Okay, so having gotten that out of the way, do you want to tell the listener about yourself a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So people probably mostly know me for working on a Ruby on Rails project called Bullet Train. So Bullet Train is it's like a starter kit for people that want to do, you know, web applications. So like if Rails wasn't already enough of a starter kit, what I sort of found in my almost 10 years of working on Rails was there were just a whole bunch of problems that I was solving over and over and over on every project. And I got sick of solving those problems over and over and over, or doing the same thing over and over. And, you know, originally when I had started developing in Rails, I thought like, oh, for sure, Rails has done all of this stuff and it's going to evolve in a certain way where it continues to do that stuff, more and more of it. And the reality is like Rails has matured really, really nicely, but it hasn't gone up the stack so much in terms of providing features. And that's mostly been left to like individual gems in the ecosystem. And there's a benefit to that. But one of the disadvantages of it is, you know, some things when you're building certain features, you're going to benefit from knowing which authentication library you're using or which security or authorization gem you're going to be using. And so at a certain point, I got sick of doing that stuff over and over and making different decisions on different projects. And I decided, like, I'm going to do this once for all. I'm going to, you know, take Devise and I'm going to take Can. I'm going to take a particular UI template and I'm going to put them all together. I'm going to wrap it up with another open source gem that I had worked on called Kodoku, subscription management for Stripe subscriptions and like pricing page and all that stuff. And I decided I just want to put all this stuff together and I want it to be prepackaged so that every time I do a new SaaS project or a new software project from now, it's always going to have these things already done. And then I can build whatever's unique about the new project. And so that worked out great. I started working on that privately. People started wanting to buy it from me. I started selling it to them. And that was great. And as time has gone on, I've just kind of continued adding. You know, people ask like, oh, you know, does it do this or does it do that? And in certain cases, a lot of those cases, it's like, yeah, you know what? That is something, that feature that you're requesting, you know, a credit system or webhooks infrastructure, Zapier integration, something to do domain management or allow, make it easier for developers to build applications that have like hosted pages as part of what they offer. You know, scaffolding around OAuth so that, you know, you're not building all these OAuth integrations over and over and over. And those sort of features, people would ask for them. And as I've had time, as I've gone through and as new customers have come in the top of the funnel or have become Bullet Train customers and asked for these things, I've just, you know, continued implementing more and more things that I want to see in a default framework so that basically all these things that I've been implementing over and over and over over the years, I now get to implement one last time, hopefully forever. So I implement it, then it's part of Bullet Train, and then I never have to do it again.
That is a pretty compelling idea. And it's almost kind of surprising that nobody else has done this. I mean, I think there maybe are other products that do similar stuff, but it's kind of surprising that there's not more of that going on. And I'm sure you were surprised too, because like you said in the beginning, Rails kind of gives you a lot of leverage. And it seemed like a safe assumption maybe years ago to say, oh, it's just going to keep going in this direction and giving us more and more leverage. And it has in certain ways, but maybe not in all the ways a person might expect. Is that kind of the way you viewed it?
Yeah, I think what ended up happening was that there was basically a line of demarcation that Rails never really went above. And that seemed to be with a handful of exceptions. And I'm thinking of Active Storage in particular, but it seemed like Rails never went above the demarcation point of Active Record. So Active Record, which was incredible and is incredible. In fact, it was incredible back in the day, and then it got even better in Rails 3. But what we never did in Rails was say, you know what, like a framework can provide user authentication, and not just user authentication, but the more general account management that is typical in applications that have like team structures with invitations and things like that. And Rails never went there. It never did the features that required, you know, two things: implementing models and implementing some sort of UI around those models. And it makes sense that it didn't, because to do that requires certain other dependencies, like a UI toolkit. So in our case, we use Bootstrap for one, but also a UI toolkit on top of that. And that's maybe too much of that. That's maybe too much omakase for Rails as a framework. But that lack of Rails going past that point to implement models and implement views and, you know, corresponding controllers for specific features, because Rails didn't do it, it left an opportunity for something like Bullet Train. And so that's, you know, that's where Bullet Train lives. It isn't trying to, you know, replace Rails. It's like Rails on Rails. So yeah, it's been awesome. I love it. And I am surprised that it didn't happen sooner. And I think you're right to say that there are probably other things out there that are trying to solve a similar problem. My experience, you know, having worked on it and kind of looked at the landscape and stuff, nobody is doing it as much, like trying to eat as much of the, you know, software sort of feature set, like for your standard application. I don't think there are any frameworks out there that are trying to do quite as much as what Bullet Train is, has both done and is kind of continuing to do, and new features that are being implemented.
And when you say that might be too much omakase for Rails itself, just in case anybody's listening who's newer to Rails and might not have come across that term yet, that's the idea that you're not arbitrarily picking all the different, you're not saying, I'm going to use can or pundit or whatever. That's not a great example, because that's not part of Rails. I have a hard time thinking of like,
it's a good example though, because it's part of Bullet Train.
Work, yeah, yeah.
Can all the way, right?
That's maybe an omakase part of Bullet Train that Absolutely. Is arguably too much omakase for Rails. It's more than they want to go. But that doesn't mean it's not, that doesn't mean it wouldn't make sense for somebody. Like somebody might want to build an application and they're just like, fine, just give me all the stuff. You decide. I'll just use all the stuff you decided. I'm fine with that because between the trade-off of getting to make all those fine-grained technical decisions myself and the trade-off of just getting it all, knowing that I'm not everything might be 100% dialed in the way that I would have done it, the speed benefit, the development speed benefit is enough that it makes that trade-off attractive.
Yeah, and the speed benefit is twofold, right? So on the one hand, all these decisions have already been made. You don't have to recreate the wheel. And they've all been integrated. That's the biggest, actually threefold. So they've all been integrated together as well. So you don't have to kind of polish the, you know, the bridge between all of those things. They've been put together and made to work well together. And then I think the other piece is once you know the structure of an application, the ability to create code generation tools for common tasks within that application, development of an application on a certain structure, you unlock this ability to know that, like, hey, if I want to add a model, here's the controller, here's the view, this is how it uses the UI toolkit, this is how it gets added to the API. This is how you add it to the API docs. This is how you enable users to be able to manage webhooks for that resource in their account and have them delivered. This is how you generate the tests for it. You can do so many things because you know, oh, and the security and permissions. That was the one that, you know, with the can thing, that was the what prompted the idea, is that it will automatically generate the security permissions for that. So it will do all of those things for you. And the reason the robots can do that for you in Bullet Train is because, and that's a feature called super scaffolding, which is also inspired by a Rails tradition that, you know, tons of people don't use. It's this super scaffolding feature that because the robots know the structure of the application and all the features and what dependencies are being used and all of that stuff, you're in a much better position to generate code on behalf of a developer. And that's one of that honestly is one of the most compelling things in Bullet Train.
I want to talk about
using it. Go ahead.
I want to bring up a couple other things on this topic, and then I want to make our transition into our other topic that we decided to talk about pre-show.
Yep.
You mentioned super scaffolding, and you mentioned how a lot of Rails developers don't use scaffolding, which I think is crazy. I use scaffolding all the time because it's just like, why would you not? And something that I didn't really realize for a long time, which I've been starting to realize, and you've probably gone way deeper into this than me, is you can build your Rails application not only from the top down, but the bottom up. And what I mean by that is, like, you can create and tweak your own generators. So for an application, a certain application that I'm working on right now, I created, one thing I did was I modified the migration generator I modified the scaffolding such that when you generate any scaffold, it will give you not the default migration file, but a modified version. And the reason I wanted to do that particular thing is because I have the audited gem installed in my application, it's Paranoia. We have the Paranoia gem installed because we want every single entity in the application to be soft deletable. And so anytime we generate a migration, I don't want to have to manually put the deleted at column in there that the Paranoia gem needs. So I modified my scaffold templates such that when it spits out a migration, it automatically puts the deleted at column into every single migration just automatically. And there's some other stuff that it does for the migrations, and there's some other stuff, like, I don't like the precise way that my controllers get spit out in the default way of scaffolding. So I modified the template and my controllers are exactly how I want my controllers to be. And I imagine like you've probably taken that principle, maybe even that exact same mechanism, and just like run with that really far in Bullet Train. Is that the case?
Yeah, so I messed around with the Rails scaffolding generators way back in the earliest versions of Bullet Train, back before it was even called Bullet Train. It was this little side project that I was working on called Shinkansen, which is the Japanese word for Bullet Train. And the conclusion that I came to was that it was I love scaffolding and I love code generation. I just had a little spark of insight at some point that this was not as, there's a reason this hasn't been broadly adopted as a developer tool for people building their own scaffolding and generators. And that's because it's different than the type of coding. So you're a very experienced Rails dev, and you're interested in, you know, this code generation and scaffolding. So you've gone in and started learning, but it's almost more like a hobby or like a niche thing that you do. It's not a general developer skill in the Rails ecosystem that people mess around with generators. And I think that's sad, but one of the things that sort of occurred to me was there's maybe a reason for that. Like, why didn't this get broader adoption? And why do so many people not like it? Why don't people just bust it open and customize it? And I came up with a sort of a different engine for doing scaffolding. So Super Scaffolding in Bullet Train doesn't leverage traditional scaffolding in Rails. People will still use the traditional Rails scaffolder for generating like migrations, but Bullet Train uses a different templating. It actually uses a templating system for its code generation. And it's quite different than Rails scaffolding in that way. And the net result of that is that you can actually use, and this is very different than Rails scaffolding, you can use the code that is the template for the scaffolding in Super Scaffolding. So if you want to generate a model, that's generated from a template of a model and a view and a controller and the API docs and the permissions and all of that stuff of an object that we have in Bullet Train only for developers called the scaffolding thing. And it's just this generic does nothing model with like a name attribute and a description. But the purpose of that model is that it is the template for the controller, for the views, for the whatever. And if you want to customize the way that scaffolding works in Bullet Train, you don't have to go learn some DSL for, oh, then make it do this and then make it add this or then make it do this. It's you're editing a template, not an herb template. Or I should say you are editing some herb templates because the views are herb, but like it's not like a generator template that you can only see the result of when you generate code. You can actually just go in, mess around with the scaffolding thing object within Bullet Train, use it, get it working the way that you want, and now every object you scaffold after that will inherit whatever feature you've added there.
Okay. So I guess what I want to say now is if you're interested in Bullet Train, dear listener, go to, what is it, bullettrain.co?
Yep, that's it.
Yeah, go there. It does cost money, so I feel like we're tantalizing people a little bit because they can't just go and download a gem or something like that. But if you're interested in it, you can go check out bullettrain.co. And, you know, if you want to mess around with these similar ideas, because I think it's a really good concept and idea, even if you don't have the luxury of using something like Bullet Train, you can still like tinker with the generators and stuff like I did, and I think that's still worthwhile.
Yep, totally.
Yeah. So I want to transition us into, we talked pre-show, Andrew, about this blog post that I had put out earlier today as we record this about service objects. So just to kind of tee up this topic, I have seen, I have encountered, including on this podcast, people recommending service objects as a way to organize Rails applications. And let me even back up a little bit. I'm sure you've experienced this, Andrew, where you work on a Rails application and either you yourself or whoever else worked on it just stuffed like everything into the active record models. That's how I coded Rails the first like good couple few years that I was using Rails, just because I didn't know that, like, I didn't realize there was any other way to do it. It's like you put the views in the views, the controller code in the controller. You want skinny controllers, fat models, and you just put everything else in the models, because where else would you put it? But that, of course, leads to really bloated models. That's how you get models with tens of methods and hundreds, if not thousands, of lines, and it's just kind of a mess. So there's various ways of dealing with this, and one common way I've heard of to address this is to make use of something called service objects. Now, what is a service object? Different people call it different things, but I think, I Googled this because I'm just like pissed off about this. I don't think service objects are a good idea, and it makes me like mad to hear people recommending them so much. So I was doing some research.
No, I actually like the way that you said that. Before you said, I don't think they're a good idea. I like the phrase that you said accidentally, I don't think they're a good deal. And I totally agree with that.
Yeah, they're
it's not a good trade-off. Anyway, keep going.
So I did some research. I just Googled Rails service objects. And I found a bunch of like really articles that were just full of really bad advice. And it made me even more upset. But so the reason I'm bringing this up is to give kind of a definition. So like among these like four or five articles that I read, and there's actually a lot more that I found than four or five, but most of them seem to have the idea that if you have an action you need to perform, like one of the examples I saw was to send a tweet, you would have a class called tweet creator or something like that. And then you would do tweet creator.call. And that's how, but that's like insane. Cause why not just have an object called tweet and do tweet.send instead? By the way, that's if you want to see that same thing, if you just Google Rails service objects, that's out of the first article that came up. So I really don't like the idea, because here's what this is. And Avdi Grimm wrote an article about this that I thought was really good. It was called Enough with the Service Objects Already. And in that, completely just lost my train of thought, but his article did a good job. Oh yeah, okay, here's what I was going to say about that. Avdi pointed out that most service objects are just kind of a container for a chunk of procedural code. And that's really what most service objects are, and they just completely throw out all of the benefits of object-oriented programming, which is that you can have a class that represents a real entity from your domain model, and that class is an encapsulation of a concept, and that concept can have behavior associated with it. And so you can package up things really tidily that way. So I guess that's what I'll say to tee that up. And Andrew, I don't know, do you have any thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, so this has been something that people have been talking about for a long time. I think that something you pointed out I forget the context in which this came out, but in your article you had mentioned, and maybe it was a Martin Fowler comment or something like that, where it effectively what it boils down to is that these service objects are like command, you know, the command pattern or whatever.
Yeah.
And for me, this never made sense at all, ever, from the first time I ever heard it. The first time I saw an example of somebody doing a service object, I just looked at it and thought, like, you're just moving code around. Like, you're just moving code over here. And I think the bigger piece of this that when you get into conversations with people about like, hey, why would you do this, or why would you move code around like this into its own class? You'll start getting into conversations about testability and trying to break out units of functionality into smaller atomic testable components. And I'm sorry, but for me, unit testability is actually not so important an attribute of code that it's worth making your code so much more complicated. And what do I mean by more complicated? I mean disconnecting pieces from the narrative of, you know, that code, separating them from their context or something like that.
Okay, and sorry, let me interrupt you real quick, Andrew, and comment on something you said before I forget. So there's one part of what you said that I don't necessarily agree with, but I don't think it matters because the whole point still stands.
No, please.
Even if you, whether you do or don't believe that unit testability of a piece of code is important, I don't believe that, not believe, it's just like a demonstrable fact, I think. I don't think that refactoring code into a service object actually makes it more testable. I think plain old objects are just as, there's nothing inherently untestable about objects. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, and I guess for me, my experience was running into lots of different, you know, desires to, situations in which people desired to use a design pattern. And the justification for doing something a certain way was it's more testable. And that testability, and what they really meant was unit level testability of that code, that somehow was the attribute that made code quality code, right? And that to me is something that I have found, I think, generally not to be true. I think my general philosophy is that quality code is code that does the job that it was supposed to do reliably. And by reliably, I mean, you know, through any mode of testing that can be applied to it, whether that's at the unit level or at a feature level or system level, whatever.
I have a slightly different view on that. Let me articulate that, and because I'm not sure what I think about that until I say it out loud. So the way I might look at that is the testability of a piece of code to me is desirable, and it's worth paying a price for, but it's not worth paying a crazily high price for. So like, if you have to contort your code and bend it over backwards and make it like crazy in order for it to be testable, then that's maybe too high of a price to pay.
Yeah, I think the issue is that different people have different ideas about what's contortion and what is, and there's probably a bunch of different reasons for that. But I think that you start getting into something that's qualitative instead of quantitative. At a high level, in fact, the reliability component of quality code, I'm going to say something that I might get quoted on later and regret it. But the testability or the reliability component of it is actually the last important piece. The most important thing that makes code quality code is that it does what it's supposed to do, and the people that it's supposed to do it for really want to use it. Like it delights them. Like it actually does a good job. And that's especially important in business. When you, like, it's one thing if you're developing internal tools and people are stuck with them or whatever, but when you're in business, developing applications and products that delight users and make them want to continue using it or convert at a higher rate or increase trial conversions to paid subscriptions, the thing that both obtains and retains customers, to me, that's quality code. When you've created code that improves people's lives because they now have less work to do, or they can do a better job with less human effort so that they can spend, you know, their precious mortal days doing things that are actually worthwhile, applying their brain to higher level problems, or taking more time away from the computer. That's quality code to me. And the fact that it does that reliably day after day without regression, that's the least important part of it, although it's still part of what I consider to be a complete view of quality code. And so,
you know, one of the reasons that I like talking with you, Andrew, is because you have a lot of opinions that I agree with and a lot of opinions that I respect but don't agree with.
I
can just comment on those last few things you said, and then I'd love to hear what you think of what I said. So I have what is kind of like a confoundingly unpopular stance on this whole thing. And I have on one hand, I have a hard time understanding why I'm like so solitary in these views. And on the other hand, I totally get it. But you know, I've heard the debate or whatever you want to call it between like shipping quickly and having code that's maybe less polished but shipping quickly, and then having code that's more polished but not shipping quickly and thus hurting the business because you're too focused on the code quality. But I think it's a little bit
quality in quotes.
Quality in quotes.
Your definition of code quality.
But I think it's a little bit of a false dichotomy, because I think people on, let's say, the leadership side, they think the choice is between A plus quality code and B quality code. They're saying, no, come on, developers, you don't need to polish every little part of it. We don't need A plus quality code. You can just ship B quality code. It's fine. But the reality, in my perception, is that the choice is usually between like C minus code and D minus code. Like the normal that would be shipped is C minus code. It's merely acceptable. But what actually gets shipped a lot of the time is D minus code. So it's not the choice between great and good. It's a choice between like okay and super bad. So the question I want to ask you now is, all right, so we agree that service objects aren't a great way to go. My reason for thinking that is because it kind of throws out the advantages of object-oriented programming. And I'm opinionated in the
totally.
Sense that I think object-oriented programming is great. I think it's better than procedural programming. So what I want to ask you, Andrew, is if you think service objects aren't good, what do you think is good instead if you're trying to address this bloated model issue?
All right. So tell me, Jason, what do you do for domain objects and how are they different than your active record objects?
I use Poros, P-O-R-O, plain old Ruby objects. And actually my method today is like, my kind of rule is if it can be extracted to a Poro, it does get extracted to a Poro. And I try to actually have very, very little inside of my models that inherit from Active Record.
And so then what do you do for persistence? Obviously you use Active Record because you're a Rails guy. How do you manage the back and forth between your Poros and your Active Record objects?
Yeah, so there's a lot of database persistence still mixed in there. So like just because something's a Poro and it doesn't itself inherit from Active Record, that doesn't mean it is completely isolated from anything to do with the database. So quite often, a Poro will accept as an argument some active record object. And I think it's totally fine to be doing .save, blah, 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 inside of those Poros. The main thing to me is just I want to have a large number of small objects rather than a small number of large objects, because I think that's easier to understand.
Yeah. So for me, I just embraced Active Record like from the very beginning. And my background before I worked in Rails, and one of the things that was so appealing to me about Rails was the fact that it had this incredible ORM object relational mapper already embedded in Rails and adopted across the entire Rails ecosystem. I mean, for the most part, there are exceptions. Some people were working on data mapper libraries and stuff like that. But my background in PHP was, and there wasn't really a winning ORM at that time.
What were you working with in PHP? Because I was too.
I was just doing, you know, vanilla PHP, some Zen framework stuff. This is back like 2010 and earlier. In the 2010 was the latest that I worked on anything.
Yeah,
in PHP.
Yeah. Like with Zen framework, it's like database, you're on your own. Just communicate with the database using PHP. It was terrible.
Yeah. And so I loved Martin Fowler's object-oriented design patterns for enterprise architecture, whatever, application architecture, whatever that the... I messed up the acronym, but that
Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture.
Oh man, I love that book. I used to pore over it and consult his site as well, like just nonstop. And for anybody that's familiar with those, and it's not important, but for anybody that was familiar with that stuff, either in the past or now, you'll remember that in that book, there were two major persistence, you know, patterns, at least two that I remember, and that was Active Record and Data Mapper. And Data Mapper was the pattern for what you're talking about, which is having vanilla object-oriented objects, data, but mostly that data was their state plus behavior, like just straight up object-oriented programming. And when it came to persistence, that was a different responsibility. So there was a different object that handled that persistence, and it was called a mapper. And the mapper provided the object relational mapping, that is to say, the mapping logic between the objects and the relational database. So that was what I did. And I had a awesome, very RL-like, like the Rails 3 version of Active Record. I had this library that I had created, totally proprietary thing, lived within this, you know, big company that we worked in, and never saw broad adoption, but...
In PHP?
In PHP. It was awesome. It was like the best thing I ever implemented in PHP. It was really cool. And I kind of looked at that and looked at that time, the future of PHP, which didn't look particularly bright. I mean, Taylor Otwell to come save the day a few years later. But I looked at that and I was like, man, this is crazy that I'm putting this thing in PHP when in Rails, they've already got this problem solved. And especially with Rails 3 and the work that Aaron Patterson did around Errol, it really looked good. And I realized that, like, I don't want to be a framework developer. I want to go higher up the stack. And all the Rails kids already have this stuff built in, and you can just build above it. So for me, Active Record is all I need. I don't find it particularly... I mean, I still use plain old Ruby objects for some things, and I use Active Model in certain cases for models that might need to be modeled but don't have sort of any need for persistence, but you still want to do things like Rails validations and things like that, like if you're doing a particular type of form object or something like that, a composite of multiple models or whatever. Those tools are still there, but for me, it's just never broken the bank technically in all of the products that I've built, in all of the businesses that I've helped build from the ground up, to use Active Record. And just if a model has a behavior, just use it, like, or just put it on the model. And does that, you know, sometimes create really large files of code? Yeah. But who cares?
Let me ask you about this. This makes me super curious.
So one second, Jason, let me illustrate one thing. I just want to conceptualize one thing before we move on. What is the benefit of moving that logic out into some other file that's more specific to like a you know, whatever. If it makes utilizing it more complicated, and more importantly, what on a computer screen, it's on your screen, and that is the only code on your screen. Whatever your viewport is, you've opened one file or another, you seek, you know, to a scroll to a particular point in that file, and you're looking at that code, and you're looking at it. Like, the code is there, or it's in a file. If it's in a long file, it's just halfway, you know, through the file. If it's in its own file, it's there. But at the end of the day, like, when it's on your screen, it's on your screen. And to me, the most important thing is that code readable? And as people go through this process of hyper optimizing their code for any number of goals, whether it's unit testability or whatever, I think sometimes they make their code more difficult to read and understand, because you have to jump between multiple files, or you have to jump all over into a ton of different methods or whatever. Whereas if it was just all there in line, you could understand it more easily. Another developer could understand it more easily. And it might be less unit testable, but I think I've already established that I don't really care about that. As long as you can test it at the system level or feature level, I'm fine with that. As long as it's not going to break, I would rather have it be easier for other developers to read. So anyways, that's the only thing I want to say. Like, let the computers do their job. It's going to show the code in one file or another on your screen. It doesn't matter if a file had 100 lines in it. Who cares? You're only looking at about 30 of them at a time anyways, unless you have my monitor, then you can see all 100 at a time.
Okay, so I think I have what's an interesting response to this question. I know have a hard stop at the end of the hour, right?
Not a big deal.
Okay. So I'll try to wrap us up soon. Andrew, we should have scheduled like 3 hours for our podcast based on... We had a great conversation, you and I, at RailsConf.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, no, we can do a part B. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah. And next time we do this, we'll block off a good half a day. okay. Okay. So here's what I was going to say in response to what you said. So I agree with a good chunk of what you said there. And I'll give a quick concrete example of when I think it's like helpful to break out a piece of code out of its active record object and into a Poro. Because I could not agree more that it's like you didn't exactly say this, but I sense that you kind of believe it. Like, one of the most important jobs, if not the most important job of the code, is to be understandable. Because, you know, the code obviously has the job of being run in the application, and that has to work, of course. But you spend a lot of time and money paying people to read this code and change this code and work with this code. So that is also a super important job for the code to be easy to understand, because then it's less expensive to work with. So,
absolutely.
So here's my example. I have some scheduling related code in an application that I've been working on for the last year. And there's a concept of an availability block. So in this particular scheduling system, people can have appointment slots. You can't just schedule an appointment for like 6:08. It has to be in a slot. And those slots are called availability blocks. What the system needs to do is it needs to disallow the ability to schedule two conflicting availability blocks. So we have to do that conflict detection somehow. One way would be in the availability block active record model, because there is a table in the database called availability blocks, and so there's an active record model called availability block. I could do it there, and in fact, I believe it started off there. But there is, you know, it's actually pretty involved to detect a conflict between two availability blocks. There's like infinite repeating to take into account and stuff like that. And so I had this kind of awkward scenario where I had this availability block class, and a lot of the methods were like little one line stuff, and then like half of the class was just all this conflict detection stuff, and that seemed really lopsided and distracting. So I extracted out a new concept that I called an availability block pair. And an availability block pair, when instantiated, you just passed in availability block A and availability block B, and then you could do dot conflict question mark. Do these two availability blocks conflict? And so then all the conflict code could be moved into there. So that's an example of when I find that kind of thing useful.
Yeah, and here's the real thing. Everybody, and this is the I feel like the real crux of the issue, is that we all get to create. You look at art, you look at all the different ways that people create art and all the different styles of art. And then you go into a specific field of art, like painting, and you look at all the different ways and all the different techniques and all of that stuff. And in our development, people should feel free to implement their code, you know, in the way that they feel, you know, works best for them. And if they're on a team, then, you know, you're going to have team consensus and all of that stuff. But like, far be it from me to tell other people how to develop their applications. But that's the issue, is that so many people out there are telling people how to implement their things. And rather than saying, this is what I do, they're saying, this is what you should do. And when that switch flips, man, you got a way higher level of accountability on whether your idea is good or not. So for you to say like, oh, this is where I would use a Poro for this particular thing. And I can think in my head, like, so internally, I'm thinking, I wouldn't use a Poro for that. I would probably, to me, it matches the pattern of collision detection in like video game engine development. And I would probably implement that conflict detection. I mean, you could either implement it on the map, or you could implement it on the, you know, people that are listening that have done any game development are probably like, he has no idea what he's talking about. And that's true. I didn't. I've only ever done that stuff as a hobby. But like, you just ask yourself, where would you implement the collision detection? Would you have a, and this is going to be funny only to Jason and nobody listening, would you create an object called the collision detector? Just joking. And right. And the inside joke for everybody else that's listening that hasn't read your blog post yet, one of your guidelines was, yeah, look suspiciously at any object that calls itself an ER of something, like some actor or whatever.
Yeah. Manager.
But where are you going to implement? Yeah, manager. Where are you going to implement that collision detection? And you're absolutely right. You could implement it in a one-off, you know, piece of logic like what you did in a class that gets used in that way. Or you could implement it as a validation on the event itself. So before an event gets added, it just goes and checks with the calendar. Does this conflict with anything? And apply some of that logic. Obviously, I'm not privy to, you know, all the complexity and stuff there. But the point is, neither one of us is telling other people that's what you should do.
Oh, I'm telling
people. It's just
an
example of what we might do.
I'm telling other people. I mean, I wrote a whole blog post saying you should do this. No, I mean, what I can tell about you from this, Andrew, is that you're like less of an arrogant, egomaniacal asshole than I am. I have no problem saying like, this is better than this. This thing that you're doing sucks, and my way is better and more correct, and you should do it that way instead. So I can understand your like egalitarian viewpoint, but for me, I think my way is better.
Yeah, and that's totally fair. But I like what you were talking about, because it puts the emphasis on domain modeling. So as opposed to worrying about individual, you know, functions or, yeah, really functions like procedural stuff, right? Like individual pieces of logic or whatever, your article is talking about reasoning about things in domain language. And that, even though I wouldn't necessarily use domain objects for all the same things that you use domain objects for, I like the philosophy that would lead you to use domain objects. And when I hear you talking about the way you reason about what are you going to name your domain objects and how are you going to organize them, it's more akin to domain modeling, which to me, that's what we're doing here. Like, that's the most important thing in our applications as developers, is to just nail the domain model. If you nail the domain model, so much good stuff comes out of that. Mm-hmm. You're the first pass of your UI and your user experience is there. Are people going to want to use it forever? No, but is it going to be logically cohesive? Yes. And then you can figure out what the optimizations and the streamlined workflows are from there. But if you nail the domain modeling, so many, that will solve more problems in the long-term maintenance of your application than if, sorry, somebody just messaged me on Slack. When I'm making my finishing point, somebody hits me up on Slack and then I'm getting
always happens.
Boom. So, but I think you take my point. The domain modeling to me is what so many other good things come out of. And that really comes full circle to like my whole emphasis on scaffolding is if you get the domain model right, then the scaffolds can do so much right for you and really streamline so much of this development so that we can start focusing on higher level problems, like what the users in our given domains, all of our different domains that we're all developing in, what they actually need us to help them get done. And I feel like that's where developers' brains, as much as possible, that's where you should be. And you only go down lower sort of on an as-needed basis.
Well, Andrew, I think you make an excellent point when you say that if you nail the domain model, a lot else goes a lot easier. And I think that's a great place to kind of tie it up for this episode. I need to invite you back for a follow-up because we didn't get nearly as deep into this as I would have loved to. So hopefully we can continue this on a future occasion. But before we go, last question I always ask everybody, where can people find you online? Again, let's give that bullet train URL and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so Bullet Train is a product. If you want to check that out and kind of see the philosophy behind that, that's at bullettrain.co. Aside from that, I spend way too much time on Twitter, and I would love to connect with anybody that's listened to the episode. So if you got this far, if you put up with Jason and I this far, hit me up, send me a DM. My DMs are open, and just let me know that you did listen so I can say thanks for your time. Thanks for sticking with us. And that's at twitter.com/AndrewCulver, and there'll probably be a link in the show notes.
Andrew, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it was awesome, Jason. Thanks so much.